The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thank you for being with us, everybody. And thank you to Tuere for joining us today, sitting with our Sangha. So Tuere Salah is a guiding teacher at the Seattle Meditation Society, and she's the founding teacher of the Capitol Hill Meditation Group. She's a retired prosecuting attorney who has practiced Vipassana meditation for over 30 years. Tuere believes that urban meditation is the foundation for today's practitioner's path to liberation. She's inspired by bringing the Dharma to non-traditional places and is a strong advocate for practitioners living with high stress, past trauma, and difficulties sitting still. Tuere has been teaching since 2010 and will be completing the four-year teacher training program through the Insight Meditation Society this May. Thank you, Tuere.
Thank you, Kevin. Kind of strange coming here, giving this talk to you, when in some respects I've been at the center so many times through the teacher training process, so I feel at home. And then there's also this uniqueness that I don't really know most of you. You may have seen me on a retreat or something, but I don't really know most of you. So there's a trust here that happens in the Dhamma that is very, very touching to me. And so I think that's what it is that I want to talk a little bit about. I want to talk a little bit about, as practitioners, why it's so important that we practice taking the time to come to this present moment here and now. Why do we even bother with all this meditation? I mean, we can do all kinds of things to settle ourselves down. Some of us run, some of us do, you know, martial arts. Some of us do crafts like the woodworking and reading and all kinds of things that we do to kind of settle ourselves down. So why the meditation? Why, what is it that we're trying to do here with meditation? And from my perspective, what are urban practitioners trying to do with meditation? You know, we can look at monastics and think, oh, they're headed right towards enlightenment and awakening, and but not us, right? We're just meditating for some other reason. And I'd like to share a little bit about why I think we should meditate and why we should take it, treat it with respect and a level of sincerity, because of what it can ultimately help us see. And maybe I'll introduce myself a little bit to you so you know a little bit about where I've come from. So I grew up in the a housing project in Seattle. And I did not grow up in a Buddhist context at all. My parents were conservative Christians and very strict. One might even go so far as to point out all the abuse that I went through when I was a child with that strictness, but it was just a very dysfunctional family. But my parents were very rigid on education. And so I went all the way to law school. And it was in law school, after law school really, that I failed the bar twice. When I failed it the first time, I thought there was something wrong with the bar. But when I failed it the second time, I thought there was something wrong with me. And I did not have that, as abusive or dysfunction as our lives can be when we're growing up, you don't know that dysfunctionality exists. So I did not know of the dysfunction until I failed that bar the second time. Somehow the whole world dropped out. Somehow everything I thought I was walking towards got disrupted. And I found the Dhamma Well, I should say, I think the Dhamma found me because I think it was probably looking for me for a while. And I finally connected to this gnawing kind of nagging thing in the back of my mind was it cannot just be about this. There's got to be something more than just this, this working hard, striving, getting to one thing. We talk about this all the time, but no matter how much we talk about it, it still seems like we are still doing and living in the same pattern, even though we talk about it a lot. And what I've come to understand over the years, I mean, finding the Dhamma, I did ultimately pass the bar, became a prosecutor, spent my life as a prosecutor. But over the years of practice, I cannot tell you that my practice ultimately came to where I was pointing it towards, because I didn't point it this way that it ultimately came. But there's a way in which practice is doing something to us. And that's what I really want to point to, is what is it that it's doing to us? What is it that it's allowing in us that if we give way to it, we allow the practice to do what the practice is intended to do. You know how our bodies are intended to eat food and digest food. So we could eat cardboard and it would digest the cardboard, but it wouldn't really get the point. Babies don't know the difference between food and non-food, so it just eats anything. And so we sort of have to learn what food is, but when you learn what food is, you can eat bad food, you can eat good food, you can eat healthy food, unhealthy food. I know plenty of people that are old folks in my family that I don't think they ate any vegetables, but, or if they did eat vegetable, it had so much meat in it that, you know, I don't know if you could call it vegetable. You might have to call it a vegetable meat mix. But even with that, they can live long, long time. And then some people can eat very healthy food and then they don't live very long at all. There's a way in which our bodies does what it does because it is the nature of the body to do what it does. And it doesn't have anything to do with you or me. And there is a thing that's happening with meditation that if we allow it to happen, we can really see some we can see a flock of blackbirds taking a wide turn and be astonished by it. So here's a couple of things. Just a framing. We live in a closed circuit mind. We don't live in a mind that's wide open and fluid. We live in a closed circuit mind. So we live in a mind that's pretty much guarded by our grasping mind that says, this is right and this is wrong. This is good and this is bad. This is pleasant, this is unpleasant. It has very strict rules and associations, and things come together in our mind and everything makes sense and we feel comfortable. Because actually, the stability that we feel in life isn't coming from life, it's coming from habit. It's coming from our habitual way of doing. So I feel still because I wake up in my own house and I have the habit of seeing that door, that wall, that kitchen, everything looks the same. So I feel solid and secure and steady. It's the habit of it. And then as soon as something outside of that habit happens, I've lost my stability, which is why this pandemic was so unnerving. I remember when it first happened, I didn't really believe I was going to be stuck in the house for a year. Okay, a few weeks. Okay, I can do a month. I can believe a couple of months. I realize it's going to take a little bit longer for this to clear out, but then, you know, a couple of months. And then months after months after months. And now I have found I have the habit of staying here. So now the mind is like, well, I don't know if I want to go out so much. I want to go out, but there's all this apprehension about going out, even if I could go out. Because we have a mind that is built on habit. And that habit becomes our stability. But that habit is not real. It is It is built on sand. It's like, I like that the Buddha would use examples of how insubstantial it is. So he said, like bubbles that rise when water is falling, the bubbles in the pond, a puddle. That, we don't think of those bubbles as being, I'm going to put my faith in those bubbles holding true. It's insubstantial. It makes sense. Or foam that comes off of the ocean. I had never seen that foam before. The example that he uses is sea foam. I've never seen that kind of foam before. But once when we were at IRC the first time and we went down to the beach area, I saw this foam. And I really did think it was substantial until you get up on it and then it's nothing. It disappears. You can see that. It's insubstantial. A mirage on a hot road. You can see. You know it's not real. That's not really water. Or a magician. We kind of know these things. But yet, we believe in our habit as if it is substantial. As if this is reality and this is the truth. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to see this, insubstantiation, to see how untrue it is. It takes a steady mind. It takes a level of curiosity and interest, and it takes a soft heart. You know, the non-judging acceptance, soft heart, steadiness, and this interest. That's what you're cultivating when we meditate. That's what we're cultivating when we meditate. We're cultivating a level of seeing that allows us to steady the gaze, that allows us to soften into a level of kindness, and that creates an interest in whatever's happening. So in less of the doing to fix the meditation and more of a watching. And I'm going to take a stab at this, but I pretty much am pretty sure that all of us on this call in hearing this talk could say, oftentimes when you're sitting there, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm looking at. I don't know what it is. Because we're taking a mind that is used to setting its understanding in habit, that's used to having labels and associations and knowing things as it knows. And we are exposing it to a vast, constantly moving Dharma. The Dhamma is moving. And our grasping mind is permanent. So the world is impermanent. It's moving all the time. And we're taking a mind that's used to labeling things and knowing things, and we're putting it in a place where we want things to just move and flow. It's not going to make any sense. Well, I should say, it's not going to make any sense to the grasping part of our mind, but it makes total sense to the embodied part of our mind. Because the embodied part of our mind is present. It's in the present moment. It knows things are instant. It knows things are insubstantial. It knows and understands the three characteristics of impermanence, subject to change, which is going to bring dukkha. And that's not personal. It knows this. So we are spending time learning how to let go of that grasping mind and relax into, get to know, begin to trust this more intuitive embodied mind. And the intuitive embodied mind allows us to see things like the blackbirds turning. Just a little bit more here. It's not easy to tap into this intuitive mind. You know this, because when we sit, the grasping mind pretty much gets in the way with all of its talking and talking and talking and rehearsing and planning and thinking, thinking, thinking. It's got plenty of stuff to say. And it waits until we're still to say it, all of it. So in order for us to access this intuitive mind, we need to be kind to the grasping mind. I used to have this, so because I grew up with a lot of trauma, I also grew up with a lot of dysfunction and I had a very aggressive, angry mind. It was pretty anxious, this whole meditation thing. And it's way too fluid for my mind. I grew up in a house full of chaos, so it wanted everything to be non-chaotic. And of course, sitting in meditation can raise a lot of chaos in the beginning. So I used to have this habit of being nice to my sort of dysfunctional, what I would call my trauma mind, because it was always thinking, this is the end, this is the end, this is the end. And so the way that I would help soothe it is the way I would help soothe my kids. And I would thank it for whatever it said. I would just say, okay, thank you. And then I would ask into the moment again. So I began to use what I would call asking questions. Like there are all kinds of practices that, you know, you can learn to do this professionally, I mean, or you can get trained in it. I just made this up for myself, but it does do wonders. I would pick something that seems hard to see, like soft. It's hard to see soft when you have a mind that is pretty rigid. It really doesn't believe soft is around, maybe some pillow, but it has even complaints about the pillow softness level. So I would ask my mind, where's soft? And it would say, you know, there's no soft. We need soft in here because it's just too hard, but there's no soft. And I would say, thank you. And I'd ask again, where's soft? In Seattle Insight, Rodney Smith, my teacher, used to do this in little discussion groups. And so I started doing it with myself. Where is it? And I just say, thank you, and then ask it again. But I learned something from doing this that has helped my practice immensely. If you begin to consider that what we're trying to see in this awakening, what we're trying to see in the idea of seeing that, if you're trying to see the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering, that there is a cause for that suffering, and that there is a cause to the way leading out of that suffering and the Eightfold Path itself. All of these list things that we've learned, they're all very difficult to see, to experience, because we have a mind that's set in habit and set in stone of the way it thinks. So when I would start asking a question, some theoretical, rhetorical, you know, there's no real answer to it, I'd ask and begin to have the mind stumble over trying to find a hardened answer. I learned something. That if our grasping mind, the part of us that needs to know, if it is not shoved, pushed, if you're kind to it, but you keep asking a question, eventually it will ask the intuitive mind the answer. This is a strange phenomenon, which is why I think some practices have you with these asking pointed questions over and over and over. Because what ends up happening is, this is the best way I can describe it. So when we're sitting in meditation, and if you, in your kindness, keep coming back to the same anchor, not forcing the mind to come back, but just in a kind way, like, thank you for that planning, but we're gonna come back to this moment. Thank you for that. Come back. I think what the mind, I'm gonna tell you what I think is happening. I think the mind is going in the back to the intuitive body and saying, hey, what is going on there? What is she asking for? What do they want? I keep telling them there's no soft around. Why does she keep asking me? Do you know what soft is? Because if you keep asking, what is soft? Is there soft? Where is it? And you don't get mad at what the mind says. Just say thank you, and you ask again. What you end up experiencing is the felt sense of soft. And all of a sudden, you feel softness everywhere. Because softness is not something you can intellectually know. It's something that we feel. So a lot of the Dhamma that we are talking about is a felt sense experience, not an intellectual concept. And if you try to force your mind to understand it, it doesn't make any sense. It will keep trying to create an image of what it is that you want in your mind, like when we're trying to get still, and we've been still before, so we're trying to get to that. And the mind will try to recreate it, but it'll constantly tell you, well, we can't get still because you need to solve that problem. You need to fix this. If you would get this done, then we could get still. And it's constantly planning, preparing, rehearsing, doing all these things in service of one day we are going to get to that moment when you were still, and that's what it's trying to get to. But you got all this mess in the way. So instead, you're trying to question into, is stillness here now? And you say, no, it's not here. Look, we got to get through this. Okay, thank you for all that, is stillness here now? No, it's not. I'm saying, I'm not still. Okay. Ask it again. Where is stillness? Here. The best example I can give this, for those of us that are older, is Karate Kid. What Mr. Miyagi did with Karate Kid is what we're doing with the mind. It's the best example. So if you haven't seen Karate Kid, or if it's been a long time, you gotta look at it. And you gotta, it's a Dhamma talk. This is not some Hollywood movie. Just ignore all the, you know, kerfuffle. But what you are learning to do is to embody the moment, not kind of know what's going on. You don't need to know. And over the years of my practice, I've learned to shift my awareness from this kind of knowing where I'm at, controlling what I see, knowing, to this more intuitive knowing that is much more trusting. So even though the mind didn't understand the pandemic when I came into it and doesn't understand what we're going to do now that it's, we're going to start having vaccinations, and am I really going to leave, and what does that mean? Am I going to go back to flying? What does that mean? Airplane? I don't even know. Really? Even though all of that's happening, inside is kind, it's still, and it's curious about the whole thing, all of it. It's not that I, Tuere, am like that. I still have the trauma mind from my childhood. But I just have a relationship with the intuitive body I was born with. And that aspect of me is very strong, very kind, and very, it's just interested, curious about everything. It's in all of us. It's not like it's in me because I got some special gift. If I had some special gift, I missed it when I was growing up. It's not that, it's in all of us. But what we're doing is we have to sit and learn to access it, because we have a grasping mind that is hell-bent on running the show. And so gradually, we keep introducing the grasping mind to this intuitive knowing mind, intuitive embodied mind. And that mind is stronger, more courageous. It's not afraid of mystery. It'll take on anything. What? Mystery? In fact, it probably is less interested in the same old. It's like, come on, let's go do something different. Let's go see. Let's notice sounds that we've never heard before. So I'm going to end here on a poem, another one. To show you, I think this poem, it points to how we do this, how we live with both this grasping mind that's set in stone, that controls everything, and this what Buddha Dasa would call Dhamma wisdom, Dhamma mind, that's very open and vast and can see and penetrate through. This is how we do it. This is called The Second Music by Annie Lightheart. And Annie says, now I understand that there are two melodies playing, one below the other, one easier to hear, the other lower, steady, perhaps more faithful for being less heard, yet always present. When all other things seem lively and real, this one fades, yet the notes of it touch as gently as fingertips, as the sound of the names laid over each child at birth. I want to stay in that music without striving or cover. If the truth of our lives is what it is playing, the telling is so soft that this mortal time, this irrevocable change becomes beautiful. I stop and stop again to hear the second music. I hear the children in the yard, a train, then birds. All this is in it and will be gone. I set my ear to it as I would to a heart. So let's just sit quietly for a moment. Thank you so much for your practice and your patience. Of course, you're all on Zoom and you're all muted, so you seem so quiet and patient. But so we'll take a little time for some questions in case people have some.
Okay, so if you have a question, and you can go ahead and use the reactions button to raise your hand and we'll call on you. Or you can post your question in chat.
I'm getting all these thank yous. Hi, Laura. So I see one question here. Capitol Hill's in Seattle, Washington. So it's just Capitol Hill Meditation Group, if you look online. And then I see Carrie has her hand up, but I'm going to answer this one question here. How do I stay consistent with practice? That's a great question, because it might seem like that. I think the question might be asking, how do I stay consistent with sitting on the cushion? That kind of practice. But one way I've learned to stay consistent with practice is I think practice is constant. I'm never not practicing. So if I am cooking dinner, I'm always using that as a meditation. I tell people on retreat, and it works really well on these online retreats, is everything you do is a meditation. So I just put the word meditation. If I'm going to the grocery store, I'm doing my going to the grocery store meditation. I learned that at retreats because the only difference between going on a residential retreat and coming, being in your house before we actually started meditating in the house was that when you would go on a residential retreat, all the work you did were called yogi jobs. I mean, you're still really just chopping vegetables or cleaning toilets, but yet it had some kind of honorable integrity to it because on a retreat, it's a yogi job. So when I would come home, that's what I started calling everything I did like a yogi job. And somehow, as an urban practitioner, we have to bring practice into our everyday existence. Because something that you can note is when we go on retreat, for those of you that have gone on residential retreats on the land, you're kind of tucked in. You get tucked into this little cocoon, and it takes a couple of days to get the mind to let go of the flow of your life. And then you're tucked into this safe space, and you can cultivate this really, really strong kind of internal connection with this intuitive, this kind of embodied mind. That's where that samadhi is, that sense of groundedness we get. And then we take that and we go out in the world and basically we let it get spent out until we can't take it anymore. We come back to a retreat, we generate some kind of a samadhi again, and we use that to go out in the world. And I like that. I mean, we definitely need to come tucked in and cultivate that samadhi. I'll be so glad when we can go back to going on the land and get that sense of tucked away experience. But as urban practitioners, we got to bring that tucked in experience into our everyday world. And probably the greatest thing that's happened to Western practice is this pandemic, where we all had to have these retreats online. If you have not done a retreat online, you got to do one. You got to know how easy it is to begin to actually allow your household to be a sanctuary for practice. When that happens, you're practicing all the time. So it's not, let me get this done so I can do something else. You can begin to feel the sense of curiosity, kindness, and this steady of mind, no matter what you're doing, all the time. That's how I have consistent practice, is I stopped thinking that I was only practicing when I'm sitting on the cushion. And something happened. When the grasping mind learns that it's okay to stand at the sink and wash dishes and you're practicing, it also won't mind doing it when you sit on the cushion. In fact, it will want to sit on the cushion. Let's sit on the cushion and try this. Well, we don't have to do anything. So my sitting on the cushion increased because I was willing to get still all over the house doing whatever I was doing. So don't limit your practice to just sitting on the cushion. Trust that if I bring this stillness, this willingness to have a steadiness of mind to the here and now, a level of kindness about whatever's arising and this curiosity in it, then I am going to, that sitting on the cushion part is gonna come. Our problem is that we keep losing it because we only think we're practicing on the cushion. And if you have dishwashers, there is no better meditation than standing at the sink and washing dishes. We got to let that dishwasher go. And you got to take some time to wash the dishes and do nothing else but stand there and wash dishes. Maybe it's the warm water. I don't know what it is, but there's something about the sound or the simplicity of washing dishes. So you can, that can be your meditation. That ultimately you are creating, like in retreat, where we cultivate continuity between the sitting, the walking, the getting up in between that and the eating and going to bed. We create this continuity. You're doing the same thing when you create that kind of continuity at home. So I thought Carrie had her hand up, but I don't see it now. So let's see.
Yeah, there's a couple of questions from YouTube, Terry. So I'm so one of them comes from Paul. He said, how best to access that second music?
This is what I was pointing to about the Karate Kid movie. So you gotta watch the movie so you can see that what Mr. Miyagi was showing this kid is that he already had access to this karate wisdom. We already have access to that music. It's already there. We have to learn to turn towards it and notice it. And so take into consideration that the grasping mind isn't necessarily going to trust it. So I used the repeated questions, rhetorical questions, to look for it. So even if you like the poem, the second music, you could ask, because, you know, what is the second music? That's just a phrase that the poet wrote, right? So you could ask, where is my second music? Where is that? Well, of course, your grasping mind's going to say, "It's. I don't know, I can't access, it's not here, because there's too much stuff going on right now." You just thank the mind for that and ask again, where is that second music? Listen for it, where is it? And eventually, your mind will ask your intuitive mind, where is it? I don't understand, where is it? And that's when you begin to access it. So that you're accessing it not from the grasping mind, you actually have to give the second music layer permission to show itself or reveal itself. And that permission has to be granted almost by the grasping mind. That's why you have to be kind to this grasping mind so that it doesn't overpower your wisdom. And that's what we do on retreats. We learn how to give permission for that intuitive mind to be present. So you're doing this in your everyday urban life. And just have patience with it. Just be very nice, very kind. Sort of like Milarepa once said, there's a quote by Milarepa. Let me see if I can remember it. Be more like a lion than a dog chasing after your thoughts, right? Because dogs chase after sticks. He says something to the effect, so one only throws a stick at a lion once. It's like, you're not going to be throwing a stick at it. So if you treat your mind like a lion, you're going to approach it with a level of kindness and care. You're not going to just be like treating it like, go get it, go get it. So that's what it's pointing to, is to treat the mind with care, but thank it and ask again. Keep asking and you'll find that second music. What's the other question?
So there's a couple of people asking about like the names and authors of the two poems you read today.
Oh, it was Blackbirds by Julie Cadwalader, C-A-D-W-A-L-L-A-D-E-R. Her last name is Staub, S-T-A-U-B. And the other one is The Second Music by Annie Lighthart. L-I-G-H-T-H-A-R-T.
And Eric, our last question, he said, what helps you to calm the judgments we have of ourselves and others?
Yeah, there's a couple of things here about busy mind and it's along the same line. So this is what I'm pointing to. This is the crust of what I'm pointing to. Judgment is part of grasping mind. Everybody on this call has a grasping mind. Comparing is part of the grasping mind. Everybody here, this is the mind that we have. The busyness, the overwhelm, all of that energy is part of a grasping mind. It's the same anxiety I had for so long. All of that is part of that mind that's trying to control everything and keep things safe and protected. That aspect of mind is not designed to harm us. It's actually designed to help us to remember when things hurt us and keep it in line, to remember what's good and remember what's bad and keep it tight, know where to go, know how to do it. It's based on surety and a sense of control, and it's not very mysterious at all. It knows. The problem is that we live in that mind. We live in that mind as if that is the mind that's going to keep us safe. And we're very much afraid of the intuitive, spontaneous, kind of mysterious, I don't know what's going to go on, let's just take it as we take it. But that is the nature of the world we live in. We live in a world that's very fluid and mysterious with a mind that's set in stone. And that is where our conflict lies. So we can't just dish this judging, comparing, like rigid fixing mind. We think more of, it's not getting rid of that mind. It's adding in the other mind. That we do have an aspect of us that's just aligned with the way things are. It's trusting, its nature is to be intuitive, its nature is to live in mystery. That aspect of us is existing simultaneously. So what we're learning to do is, how do I not disrespect this mind? As in the hood, we'd say, throw shade on this mind in order to say, I'm in this mind, look, because we won't stay very long. We'll be in it, and then this mind will mess it all up. So instead, we want to give respect and honor to this mind. But know that there is a completely different world, a different way of existing in the moment. And we are going to learn how to touch into that. You do it at home, you do it when you're sitting, you do it when you go on retreat, you just do it as often as you can. You listen for the second music. You listen for the intuitive mind in any given moment. And you never disrespect or get mean to this grasping mind, because it's not designed to see it. It's designed to keep us steady and safe. But that other mind is there. And gradually, I think enlightened beings walk around in the world knowing both of those minds. And their intuitive mind is far superior. Instead of it's flipped for us, our grasping mind is more superior. And so we're just learning to balance this out so that it's steadier. All right. Well,
do you have time for one more question?
Sure.
So Carrie, I think, who had her hand raised.
Yes, she did.
So she asked, have you experienced a shift in the trauma mind over time?
Yes. This is what I'm pointing to. Trauma mind, grasping mind. It did not know how to manage the world that I was living in when I was a kid. So it came up with all these structures and systems and thoughts and mechanisms to try to help me. And I lived through that. And when I failed the bar, what I thought was a perfect understanding of the world came crashing in on me because it didn't work. So, I mean, I had to do 20 years of therapy to get rid of trauma mind. Don't get it twisted. Dhamma is not therapy. It's not gonna do the therapeutic thing. Because it's not, in one respect, Dhamma doesn't care if there's trauma in the space. It's more like, do you know there's trauma in the space? But most of us, when we get trauma, we get triggered in trauma, we don't even know we're in that trigger. So this is more about, do you know? Where Dhamma helps in trauma, assuming that you have worked through the therapeutic side of it, psychological side of it, where trauma really helps, where Dhamma helps, is it is the aspect that allows us to bring a degree of softening and kindness and curiosity around whatever's happening. So what I found was I became less and less panicky about the anxiety or the fact that I just got triggered, or I just had more capacity to be with unpleasantness, to be with anxiety and see it for more what it is. And the grasping mind cannot do that. It cannot be with anxiety with any degree of trust because it's too judgmental. Basically, anxiety is bad. There's just no way around it. Nobody wants it. But we have an intuitive side of us that knows anxiety is here. It's not caught in the anxiety. And it can steady us and say, well, what's up? Wait, not actually having a heart attack. Nobody's actually hitting us. Hold on just a moment. That aspect is an intuitive mind. And so practice is about learning how to rest in that intuitive mind and not letting our grasping mind basically tell us what to do. That's why when you're there sitting, you're gonna feel unpleasantness. Practice being with that unpleasantness a little bit. I'm only gonna sit here for 5 minutes. Can I just be with this unpleasantness? The mind is all talking. Not gonna try to get rid of that. Just wait, just okay. Do what you gotta do, talk. Let me just see if I can settle in the body and notice that I'm doing all that talking and not caught up in it. That is something we learn how to do. It's not something that just happens. So you're gonna practice and sometimes you're not gonna be able to get out of I couldn't get out of that anxiety, violent kind of thinking and I just have to get up. But sometimes I could I see something. And then it's all gone again. And then, back, I'm stuck in it. Our practice, Sangha, is really what helps us just keep doing it. Just keep trying and keep trying and keep trying. And over time, you don't have to fix it. The mind will do it on its own. I see one more hand here. Gary?
Yeah, we've got Jerry. Let me go ahead and unmute him.
First of all, thank you very much for an excellent Dharma talk. I really appreciate it. So I just wondered in terms of, I'm a psychiatrist and I try to help a lot of people in Toronto. And of course, a lot of people are frightened about COVID. And you spoke about the grasping mind, about keeping us safe and the intuitive mind. Am I to take that both are necessary, but perhaps in our society that the intuitive mind has been unnecessarily suppressed and that it needs to be brought into balance with the grasping mind? Do I get
that's
it right?
That's what I think. I'm going to give you an example I gave to my Thursday night Capitol Hill group. This is the best way I can explain it. So I have an outlet in my house that was connected to a fan and I didn't think it worked. I mean, that's how I bought the house and it didn't work. And so we took it off the price. And so it didn't work. 20 years I've been in this apartment. Never used that stupid outlet. Somebody asked me, well, why don't we put I've always wanted an outlet over there, but I don't have one because, it doesn't work. So my friend who does electric things said, why don't we put an outlet there? I said, it doesn't work. He goes, well, I mean, does it have wires? It's like, well, yeah, but it doesn't work. He goes, well, can we see? He opens it up, and of course it works. I could have had it 20 years ago. Okay, it works. So he puts an outlet there and plugs in an extension cord, not even anything of power, just an extension cord to show me it worked. I'm like, oh, it works. And then maybe, I don't know, maybe about an hour later, the power goes off and it goes off in the house. And of course, I think I should have never did that outlet. That's what did it. It was the outlet. He goes to her, there's nothing plugged in. It would have, if it were too much power, it would have happened immediately. Like, no, it was me. And then I went to the door and I looked down the hall and I'm like, oh, I've taken out the power on the whole block. And then it turns out, Capitol Hill, my whole neighborhood, the power's out, all because of me. The grasping mind, it associates. This is what you would know, Jerry. It's like it associates things and connects things together, and it creates stories based on that. The intuitive mind is much more connected to just what is arising in this moment. So the biggest problem with COVID was and is our fears is what we think is going to happen. It's the extrapolated stories that get drawn out. And Dhamma is about here and now, this moment, this moment, this moment. And the more we learn to acknowledge that this moment, even though the story, as much Dhamma as I had, I still had this mind that was growing ever big of trauma that was about to happen. And what saved me was a friend of mine sent me an email that said, oh, are you stuck in a power outage? I heard Capitol Hill had this, the snow, it was snow at the time, the snow broke some power line. And are you stuck in, no electricity? And I was like, oh, that's where it comes from. But you can see that how easily the grasping mind, it didn't have anything to do with me, is what I'm saying. The mind just envelops and goes on its own. And we kind of go with it, unless you have some ability to kind of stay. So the old me would have pretty much panicked. I would have shut down. I would have been in anxiety. I wouldn't even have been able to hear if someone did tell me that it was from a power line. I would have insisted that this is what it was from, me. I would have closed that outlet off and I would never use it again. But this, what Dhamma has taught me is to be in the here and now. And in the here and now, I can tell, oh, that is a trauma mind. That is not reality. Reality, it happens, it comes. It doesn't have to rock me forever. I don't have to shut off that whole side of the house, sort of like I did in the beginning, or it doesn't work. I can actually allow the present moment to have influence on me. You see that is what it is that I think Dhamma can help people begin to do what you could consider a double check. You can double check the present moment to see if it's in line or in keeping with the mind's story it's creating. And double checking that story against reality, it begins to help us learn to see the difference between the stories that our minds are creating and the truth of what's actually going on. So what could have been a really long-lasting problem ended up only lasting about an hour. See the difference?
Yes, that's very helpful. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. To Ari, actually, Dunder actually had a question. I don't know if you still have time to take that. So he asks, or they ask, where do these two minds come from, grasping mind and the intuitive mind? And then he has a follow-up. Is there an evolutionary background for these two minds?
I don't think that there are. I don't think of it as, I don't know about the its evolutionary nature of it. I guess what I would say is the two minds I'm speaking of is like digestion. It's like our respiratory system. It comes with the package. So grasping that, I guess you could call it reptilian brain, but I think I've heard from a couple of Dhamma teachers that are scientists also that it doesn't really line up with the reptilian brain like we try to say it, but there is an aspect of mind that compares and judges. It's the name and form aspect of the link on the dependent origination. So this mind just automatically does this. There's an aspect of mind that automatically labels things as pleasant, unpleasant, and neither. So that part of mind is what we tend to live in our urban society. There is still an intuitive mind. You know it because something as simple as you can walk into a room where two people were arguing. They're not arguing now, but you know something went on. You don't know what happened, but you know something went on. Or you can look at two people and say, oh, they like each other. Oh, I can see. You just have this intuitive sense. So we do have an intuitive capacity, consciousness of knowing and penetrating through. Mostly we don't come to that knowing until we go into a retreat where we have shaved away all of the other distractions and we can point our mind towards it. And what we're learning in practicing in urban life, you're learning how to be and cultivate that intuitive mind in the midst of a lot of distractions. So it's harder, but it still can be done. All right. Great. I think we've probably used up all our time now.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Okay, good. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, you know. I hope to see you again. Bye. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.